welcome to today's version of The Hours. I apologize, my voice is hoarse, but I think you as coaches will identify with coach's voice, as last night I had 2 hours with my 11 and 9-year-old daughter's team. So I had 12 11 and under girls run around the gym. So there was a lot of cheering going on. So hopefully you can get past the hoarseness of my voice. Mark, do you get coach's voice? And if so, what's a tip that you could give a coach? You could give a coach to help get their voice right in the middle of the season?
I definitely get coach's voice, especially early in the season. Even when we travel and do these program clinics, sometimes after day one, I am hoarse. First week of practice, I always remember after the first day, just lose my voice. And then, like anything, the more you use it, it'll adapt and get better. So no tips on coach's voice other than just coach more.
Well, that's a good segue, because today we want to talk about the danger of tips and technique. The danger of tips and technique. And I think that small anecdote is a great example of the danger of a tip. So Mark could give us a tip like drink hot water with lemon and honey. There's a tip for coach's voice. But in reality, that tip really isn't going to move the needle very much. What's going to move the needle is you coach for months on end and your voice strengthens. And I think that's the danger of providing tips to coaches or tips to players, is we rely too much on that tip quickly fixing our pain point. And when it doesn't, we get frustrated. Instead, there really is no tip. There really is just establishing a direction, holding a high standard, and having the discipline to do the hard things over and over again, much longer than your competition would, even after it's uncomfortable, even after you fail. And that's when you have breakthrough. The danger of tips is it creates a mindset of quick fix. And I'm going through that as a father right now in all things with my kids, is we live in a society that is a tip society. If I can't learn it in 60 seconds on Instagram, well, then I'm going to move on and this isn't for me. And nothing great was ever built quickly. Anything great took time. Hardwood grows slowly. And so I think we're going to give you a number of examples of where maybe we expect tips to fix it, or we have a tip mindset or a microwave mindset, but savvy coaches understand that nothing that is worth doing is going to be done quickly. And this is the stuff good coaches should know. And so, Mark, let me ask you this. Where have you, in working with coaches or working with players or as a leader, as a parent, where have you observed a tip mindset or players, coaches looking for tips where, in fact, tips wouldn't even help? Instead, we need to develop a new approach.
Yeah, I go back to some actually questions that we get in a community, and they are just such broad questions of, I think back to one I got recently was, coach, how do you build team chemistry on and off the court? And I'm like, gosh, I have a lot of things that would really help, but if I could give you one thing, like you said, band-aid mindset, right? So, when I get asked a question like that, I'm like, well, how much time do we have? I think that is more for a coach that really wants to go deep into something and is going to do a long-term study to do anything. And it goes to, you were talking about the struggle and the patience to acquire any type of skill, to make any type of noticeable change. We need three things. We need action, we need struggle, and we need patience. So we actually have to go out and do what we're trying to do. So if it's acquire a skill, if I want to be a better shooter, I got to go out and I've got to shoot. And with that, I'm going to struggle, but I need the patience to persevere through that. A tip is not going to really help me become a better shooter unless I go apply those three things, action, struggle, and patience. I say all the time, telling someone to do something does not change behavior. I can ask you to be a better shooter. I can tell you to lose weight. I can tell you to be on time more. But if we don't make some type of action, there's going to be no value in that.
Action, struggle, patience. Those are beautiful three steps. Let's go a little more concrete on each of those, or I'll give a small anecdote on each of those. I'll pause at the end of each one because you might want to go a little bit deeper. Because again, action, struggle, and patience. Great. That's good. I love that. Okay. How do we move that from a tip to application? And that's really what savvy coaching is. It's wisdom applied. Like if someone's savvy, they're wise, they're smart, they're clever, right? But how do we go from knowledge to doing it? And that's how we apply the wisdom. So we always want to go there with what we share and what we teach here on the hours. Action. One of my favorite Chinese proverbs is move and the way will open. And it's a bit of a juxtaposition, because if we don't see the open door, oftentimes that leads to stagnation and staying still. Whereas like this is where action is required. Once you start moving, then your perspective changes. When you're stationary, you can't see an opening. But just by moving two steps to the right, you might see an opportunity that you didn't see from your current perspective. Most coaches, and everything we learn as coaches, we can apply as players, but most coaches stay still, meaning too often do the same thing that they've always done, say the same things they've always said, and so they can't even see a different way. The opportunity to change your perspective is just move two steps to the right, embrace a new opinion, try something new. And it may not be a complete change in your beliefs or your coaching, but it will offer a new perspective and it will lead to growth. Move in the way will open. Action is required. Whereas a tip doesn't always require action. It's just a new way of thinking. Try it, implement it. Anything to add on the action step, Mark?
Yeah, I think just to start, right? We're going to talk a lot about technique and where that fits in your practices or the way you coach your team. But try to apply just one thing that we share today. If we share, you know, four or five things and it becomes overwhelming, I would say just start with one thing and try to stay away from what you're inclined to do, what your comfort zone is, or what the majority does, because the majority of coaches actually don't produce exceptional results, right? The majority of coaches are always trying to get better and better and better because they're leaving some meat on the bone somewhere. Exceptional results are going to come from doing what the uncommon coach does. So I would just say start, and as you get more comfortable, keep applying it into new areas.
Beautiful. Struggle. Struggle equals stretch. We did this last night with our players. I gave a scorecard to each player. We identified a strength and a stretch. When you stretch a muscle past what's comfortable, it hurts. And it's the same thing when you stretch a player into a new aspect of a game or stretch a coach into a new way of doing things. Struggle is required in order to move into a new range of motion. And if we are unconscious or unintentional with our approach to teaching, with what we teach, with how we teach, if we're unintentional, we won't stretch. Because how human beings are wired is to avoid pain. It's how we stay alive. And so unintentional coaching will lead to stagnation, will not lead to struggle. Only by intent and creating systems and seeking the discomfort that Mark shared, will you embrace the struggle that does lead to growth. Again, a tip doesn't lead to struggle. Tips, by definition, make things easier, right? Tips don't lead to struggle. The desire behind a tip is, I want an easy way to get this player to do this thing. I want an easy way to score a basket, right? Oh, I want a quick hitter, right? I want an easy way to get a bucket, but that quick hitters don't lead to struggle. Quick hitters alleviate struggle. Struggle is teaching principles where players learn reads in order to achieve success. Well, when you teach that, they're going to get worse first. Not you're going to miss more shots first. Struggle is required. Mark, talk to me a little bit more about patience, because I have nothing helpful to add about patience because I lack it.
Well, you just hit on it. You said sometimes when we teach players a new skill or we challenge them to go reads first, then they're going to get worse before they get better. So that's where the patience is required. And in a coaching example would be, we try something new and it doesn't look immediately the way I wanted it to look, right? Or I start to get uncomfortable and it's like, ah, we're not good at that. So we're not going to do that anymore. And so I think patience goes into just leaning into the adversity and knowing that if we are struggling, that's actually a good thing. As a coach, your goal, and as a player, your goal should be to build skills beyond your talent. And there are three zones that you can operate in. Is one is your skill exceeds the challenge. That's going to be, well, if we're talking technique, that's probably going to be where we could work just technique, right? And you're going to be very comfortable. Second zone is our skill is equal to the challenge, where you might test your skills, but there's still some level of comfortability there. Zone three is the challenge slightly exceeds the skill. And we don't want the challenge to far exceed the skill, because then players become demoralized, unengaged, right? Frustrated, right? So they don't lean into the adversity. We want the challenge to slightly exceed skill, so we expand our skills and we build. That's where we keep getting better and we build our skill beyond our talent. So that just requires patience, just staying the course, knowing that if you're struggling, that means you're growing.
Yeah. Okay. Let me take us on a walk down memory lane, my memory lane, and attach it to what we do here at Savvy. One of my basketball mentors, a teacher by the name of Dina Evans. Dina Evans led Point Guard College for many, many years. And she was really the first person that taught me how to teach the game. She's one of the best teachers of the game that I've ever been around, and a deep thinker, highly intelligent, played at Virginia, Final Fours, amazing, amazing woman. She said something that got pounded in my brain over and over and over again when she was teaching thousands and thousands of point guards how to play the game. She said this: technique is the equalizer. In teaching players how to develop and how to grow, she said technique is the equalizer. The equalizer, because again, this is Point Guard College, where generally we're teaching thousands and thousands of very high IQ players that are smaller, shorter, and oftentimes less athletic than the ones that just are gifted with the speed, strength, and size. And she said, because she was a smaller point guard, she's 5'2", played at Virginia. She said, technique is the equalizer. And I just took that as gospel for years and years and years. Technique is the equalizer. Technique is the equalizer. I no longer believe that technique is the equalizer. I actually believe that technique is the outcome of the equalizer. And I want to share this with coaches because I believe that we can apply this on our journey, but we also need to embrace this when teaching players in any discipline. I believe that the equalizer is actually time. Time is the equalizer. And I was actually, this graphic was texted to me by one of our Savvy coaching members who came across it. I posted it a long time ago for those of you listening on the pod. It's the time principle or the time formula. And I'll talk us through it a little bit. Technique is the product of a lot of time. The only way to develop technique, like excellent technique, is a ton of time. So when you spend a ton of time taking action, going through struggle, and exercising patience to do it over a long time, the outcome is technique. But the equalizer is time. If Mark is naturally more gifted than me, or more physically gifted than me, or in a better situation than me, or naturally more intelligent than me, the only way that I can equalize with Mark is by me investing more time than him, and time in a better way. And this formula that I'm sharing here is how you can invest time in a better way. Now, the outcome of that is going to be a technique that's hard earned. But the technique is not something you can get as a tip. The technique is not something that you can implement immediately. The technique is just a sign that you've invested the time. So here it is. Time is basically this. Like hours, T, time, hours times intensity. So the amount of time you spend plus the how intense that time is invested, like the level of effort that you put into that, that will be divided then by the mindset that you bring into the time that you spend. If you bring a mindset of, I need a quick fix. I need a quick tip. I need this to happen instantly. It will actually degrade. It will divide the outcome of the time that you spend. So it's time times intensity divided by the mindset that you bring, the approach that you bring. You bring a beginner's mind or you bring an expert's mind. You bring a quick fix mind or you bring like this is a marathon mind. And then that will lead to the effectiveness, the E of the time that you spend. And that's really what we're trying to do at Savvy Coaching is we're trying to help you bring more intensity and a better mindset to the time that you invest so that you become more effective. But what we can't do for you, what a coach can't do for a player, is we can't invest the time for you. We can't give you a quick tip or just a technique that's going to shortcut the time that's required. Anything you want to add to that one, Mark?
Maybe it's important to define what we mean by technique, because what I've found is that a lot of coaches equate technique with skill. So if we say, oh, we're doing a lot of skill development today, what they really mean is we're doing a lot of technique work today. And I would argue that we should spend less time on technique. When I think technique now, and I haven't always thought this way, I've really grown and educated myself, and it made all the difference in the world in how I coached. But this is how the details, the body movements, the mechanics of how we execute a skill. So it could be our hand placement on the ball or our body positioning, our footwork, our foot placement. For instance, like I know you work with a lot of really great shooters, and I think you are one of the best shooting coaches that I've ever been around. And a lot of your feedback could be technique driven. You know, a common thing we like to tell players to do is to just change the angle of their feet, right? And not 10 toes to the rim. That would be technique because we're changing their footwork, but that doesn't mean that we're improving the overall skill of shooting. To me, the most important skill in terms of shooting, or really any skill, would be, do I know when to shoot? Do I know when to apply the technique that you're giving me? I'll give you one example. I'll give you a defensive one here, because most of the time we probably are talking offense in terms of skill, but I think this will easily highlight what I mean between technique and skill. Let's say you are a help defender and somebody drives to the baseline and your job is to stop the drive. First, you have to have vision. Okay. You have to be in help, be in the right position. You have to see the ball. Then when the ball is driven, you've got to decide, do I need the help or not? That is decision-making on the defensive side. Let's say you decide to help. Then I think technique comes into place. Well, how do I help? Do I want to have a wide base, right? We want to be too wide with our feet, meaning, you know, we talk about shoulder width wide would be like one player wide. Let's go too wide. Let's get a little bit wider and let's put our hands up so we get big and we show the ref our hands. That might be technique. What I would focus on more as a coach is my player in position? Do they have vision of the ball? And do we help when we should? And do we stunt, skirmish, stay at home when we should? Then we've got all season to clean up technique. Most coaches would teach technique of help and get frustrated maybe when their players don't help. So I would ask the coach this: would you rather a player that almost always helps when necessary with poor technique, or would you rather the player with perfect technique but misses help consistently, rarely in the right spot, not assertive enough in help? I think we would all want the first player because we can work with that player and improve their technique. So I would say technique, I'm almost going to say, is important, but I think the message here is that focus on technique less. Maybe technique shortens the path to improvement. So you're a great helper. Here's how we can make that even better. We'll give you some tips or technique there.
That's one of the best examples of technique versus skill I've ever heard. Okay, this is huge. Okay, so if we're going to deprioritize technique, what do we do instead? And again, skill versus technique are the two words that we're using here. And I would offer up that a skill is a solution as technique is an input, or skill is an output, technique is an input. So there's the problem of help. The solution is how you help, right? Technique would be, okay, these are some inputs that might help you provide help. So I think these three things are more important for skill acquisition than technique. Remember, technique is not the skill is the output, right? A technique is an input, right? here they are in order. I would develop and identify these three things over technique. One, cleverness. Cleverness is more important than technique in order to develop skill and provide solutions. Cleverness is the art of deception. So more, if you're attempting to finish at the rim, using cleverness or deception or fakes or speed changes or unexpected solutions is more valuable than the technique of a stride stop and how they put their feet in or whatnot. Cleverness is more important. It's a mindset, right? It's which creates an output. So I would identify, teach, and train cleverness. We have a limited amount of time in order to develop better finishers. Is playing off of 2 feet important? Incredibly important. But if we only have 30 minutes to develop finishing, I would rather develop the mindset of seeking clever solutions using deception as opposed to just hammer the technique of how to stop on 2 feet and lowering your hips and what stride stops versus quick stops. The mindset will provide the solution. The technique will not necessarily provide the solution. Cleverness is a mindset. That's one.
Just as far as de-emphasizing the technique of the stop, think about it this way. Let's say we're running lines, which I wouldn't suggest that you do, but most coaches do it, right? Let's say we have 11 seconds to go down and back, or we're doing the old 17 sidelines in a minute. Do we ever say, this is the technique to slow down, stop, and touch the line, right? Our players figure it out, right? So take that approach, and then that would be being more clever, right? Your players will adapt and find a faster way to start and stop just by doing it. They probably don't need your tip or technique in order to do that.
Yeah, and the clever players cheat it when the coach isn't looking and actually stop short of the line and find a way to get faster. I love a good cheater, as long as they don't get caught. And when they get caught, they become better cheaters. Isn't that great? Yes, exactly. All right, the second one, smart. Again, if we're defining terms, clever is the art of deception, whereas I would offer up that smart is more the art of identifying strengths and weaknesses. So that's what I would suggest is smart. Smart, it would be moving from reaction to prediction. So let's go, there's technique in how to get faster and, you know, foot placement, and even like your plyometric training, and a player might be able to get a little bit quicker, 10% quicker over years and years of technique training for speed. Whereas if they can move from reaction to prediction within a minute, they will appear so much faster than years and years of technique training. So that's what I'm going to define as smart. It's moving from reaction to prediction. I react to the ball being passed to the player that I'm guarding, and then I go and close versus I predict the ball is going to be going and I start moving in advance. That's smart. And moving from reaction to prediction is what is going to develop. And we call that pattern recognition. So instead of saying, okay, focus on internally what your body's doing, I actually think that lowers the amount of awareness they can have to focus externally to recognize patterns and anticipate patterns. So a lot of times technique can make it harder for your players to play smart, which is moving from reaction to prediction. All right, let's flip that one to you before I go to the last one.
I was going to say pattern recognition. That's where my mind went. Elite decision makers can recognize and memorize patterns faster than a novice can. Also, they can predict, like you said, future events easier than a novice can. I think that just comes with having a trained eye. So I've been in this situation before. This is likely going to happen, which is going to help my decision-making going forward. Again, vision precedes decision. Decision precedes skill. An expert or somebody that can predict the future or see patterns is going to do that more consistently than a novice.
So when designing practices, coaches, what we're suggesting is isolate the patterns that you think are most important for your team to improve in, create a game that's going to create those patterns over and over again and direct players' focus to what cues, visual cues, they're looking for as opposed to technique. Here's an example. Our team needed to get better at rebounding. And so last night we played a game 4-on-4 that began with a rebounding situation. And then they played the game. And so we worked on the game. And then I said, all right, when you are erasing, when you're in the smile, when you see yourself in the smile, you're going to look for the nearest player and hit them. When you are outside of the paint, you're going to look for the nearest player and then go chase the ball. That's what you're looking for. That's the pattern I'm trying to put you in. And then we just played live off of a shot, OD live, played to a score, and just put them in the patterns over and over again. We spent zero time on the technique of a box out. And instead, we looked for, okay, can I recognize what I'm supposed to do and when and begin to anticipate it? That's the same thing that we teach around shell drill, right? Shell is trying to put them in patterns. The problem is, when they're in those patterns in a shell scenario, they're not actually going to prediction and doing anything about it. Instead, they're responding to the pass as opposed to predicting the pass and anticipating and trying to disrupt it. So that's the difference between reaction and prediction. We want to put players in game situations where they can actually predict and win as opposed to consistently train them to react, which is what is traditionally done.
Yeah. We want to couple perception with action, right? So train the eyes first, tell them what to look for, and then that's going to cue the action. When we work things in isolation, I think we make players worse. So if you use the stride stop or a quick stop example, if we just work stride stops and they're going to stride stop over and over and over and over and over, they don't know when to use that. To me, skill is technique plus game context. So the stride stop is maybe teaching the technique. The actual skill requires game context. When do I use a stride stop? So shell drill, we're going to pass one pass, jump to the ball, another pass, jump to the ball, another pass. After the third or fourth pass, your players are going on autopilot. And every time we go on autopilot, I think we actually get worse. And then to go back to time, then we start wasting time as well.
Yeah. Lower intensity, right? The divided by a disengaged mindset. Yeah. Less effective. Okay. The third step in development, all three of these steps, again, I think should come before technique and be prioritized above technique. And I think that this is the common pathway to developing skill. Let me review, because I know it's a lot of new concepts here. I would suggest cleverness, not in isolation. These things all inform each other, but if you're going to direct a player's attention, cleverness, the art of deception, smart, moving from reaction to prediction using pattern recognitions. What do I look for and how does that couple to an action? Third is going to be strategic. And strategic is moving them from reading the script to writing the script. So everything we talk about smart would be reading the script, pattern recognition. I can read the pattern, I can read the script, and I can predict what's likely coming next, right? The next step would be, I'm actually going to write the script. I'm going to create the pattern. This is what the highest level point guards in the WNBA and NBA do in ball screens, is they actually write the script, right? LeBron James knows how shooter X is going to be covered, so he puts them in this corner. He tells Anthony Davis where they're going to flip the screen, because LeBron knows that's where the least amount of help is going to come from based on the script that he's writing. Okay. That's what strategic means. You write the script. Or simply enough, in like a smart would be, I can react to the pattern of a mismatch and then go and recognize it. Strategic means I'm going to create the mismatch, right? And we're going to go punish it. These are all solutions to problems that have nothing to do with technique. And as a player moves through this script from clever to smart to strategic, guess what they're going to develop over time? The techniques, right? And once they have this mindset, they can add new techniques like that. Whereas, have you ever noticed that the beginner player, it's really hard for them to add technique? It's because they don't have the clever, smart, and strategic network. So technique is important. It just should be taught last, in my opinion. Now, last isn't at the end of their career. Last is at the end of a cycle. There are infinite cycles of development in player development. It just should be last in the cycle. Do we develop the art of deception and cleverness with a player? Do we help them recognize and tell them where to look a little bit, and they have some growth there? Now, do they get strategic in how they can utilize this in games? Then give them a piece of technique and then start the cycle over again. Well, I think we have answered the problem with teaching technique first. Shall we transition to the mailbag?
Yeah, although I could talk about that for days on end. We could do a series of pods on that. But yeah, let's go to mailbag.
We might have to. Well, actually, before we move on, let me challenge our listeners to this. Coaches are sharers. The greatest coaches are the greatest sharers. I know Mark and I have benefited from so many coaches that were willing to share the game. If you are a savvy coach or you're listening to this, please be a sharer. If you think that this adds value, don't keep it to yourself. Our mission at Savvy Coaching is to share the game, but we don't know the coaches that you know. I would love it if you would share this podcast with every coach in your network. I think that that is honestly how we could have the ripple effect of impacting the game. So please be a sharer. Don't keep the gifts to yourself. Share this with coaches. That is how we all get better. So please be a sharer.
Yeah. I would also say, reach out to us if you have an opinion on this, or do you agree, disagree? What's been your experience? Or if you want to go deeper into this, reach out either to us directly or by joining our community and dropping it in there. Always really good engagement.
And thank you to all the coaches that have joined the community. Honestly, it's blowing me away. We have over 1,300 coaches in the community now, interacting, learning, getting better, all for free. And thank you to the coaches that are joining and sharing that as well.
Mailbag time.
Let's go.
I'll hit you with one on shooting ladder. I feel like shooting ladder comes up in the mailbag a lot. And this is one from Isaac. He says, I'm doing a shooting ladder every day, and we are testing daily and rescoring every week. What are your thoughts on rescoring it weekly? So I guess starting the ladder over again, is it getting away from the initial design and purpose by doing that?
I would say yes, without knowing your specific situation. Let's go back to Mark's great point of action, struggle, and patience. All right, you're taking action. You're creating a competitive cauldron around shooting. Awesome. You're getting some benefit there. Struggle. It should create struggle. And it should create struggle for the players that are not at the top of the ladder. And then it should require patience. Shooting especially requires patience. It requires patience, time, and investment for someone to move up the ladder. If you rescore it weekly, my concern is it would move towards the place of a tip. You can't get up the ladder? Well, here, just have a great shooting day this week, and all of a sudden you're at the top of the ladder without the struggle or the patience.
Yeah, I think this is an example of when we get asked a question. I know for me, most of the time, I just have more questions for the person that asked the question of, well, how many drills are we tracking, right? How many days a week are we practicing right now? Without knowing all that, I would say stay with it longer. We would stay with ours for maybe even a semester, just to get a huge sample size. And then if we wanted to reset, but I think if you're resetting weekly, if somebody has, you know, there's going to be so much variability week to week, are we really identifying who the best shooters are, and are we tracking improvement? So, maybe keep a long-term overall season-long ladder, and then maybe do something monthly or every 2 or 3 months. But I would say weekly would be maybe a little short. All right, Tyler, I'll hit you with one more.
Please.
And this is a high school coach that wants to give some guidance to his junior high program. What are the two most important skills you would want them to learn during the season to prepare them for a race in space or a drive in space system in high school? I'll ask this one of myself. I'll go maybe a little different than what you do, hopefully. I would teach this more tactical skills of spacing and ball movement. I would want, we could go into more, you know, specific skills of you know, develop core four skills, right? Can we play off the catch? Can we start and stop? But you probably are already doing that in your junior high program. If not, maybe I would develop a core four skill. But I would say, zooming out, if I was to inherit as a high school coach players that understood spacing and ball movement, I would have a really nice canvas to work off of.
I'll answer my two quickly. Play really, really fast and shoot lots of threes, which is the opposite of what most junior high coaches are going to want to do. So that's why it's so important. They're going to be like, slow it down, because it's hard for especially a less experienced coach to even keep up with the speed of the game to feel like they can have input. So that's why a lot of coaches want the game slowed down, because it's more comfortable for the coach on the sideline, because it's easier to joystick and have input live in a slower game. So like, understand the why. So saying you got to get them to play fast, so fast you actually don't know what's going on until you watch the film or afterwards. And then shooting lots of threes is also the opposite, because junior high players can't make threes. And so you're not going to score as much, and you're going to see a lot of misses. But again, that's going to lead to the action struggle and patience required for really getting a great product down the road.
Yeah. I'll ask you one more, and then you can ask the next one. This one comes from last week's podcast where we talked about split action. This coach says, we've incorporated split action and they're splitting off a post feed, but his frustration is he feels like the ball is sticking a little bit more when they're in a split. So he asks, is this just a product of running split action and the ball needs more time to hold and stick longer than usual? So what would you say to that?
Yes.
I mean,
yeah,
we talked about how we would, or I know I said I would teach triple threat last, right? That would be the last thing I would want my players to do, because we want to play off the catch. But if you're running an off ball action, at some point the ball has to see the action, right? In 0.5 basketball and playing off the catch, there is some value in when you're neutral to moving the ball quickly, because now rotations are faster, right? We're moving defense right to left. Ball movement is important, but it's more emphasized in dominoes. We're running split action to create an advantage to get us in dominoes, and now we're going to really emphasize 0.5. When we're in dominoes, we never want the ball to stick. Nothing stops the ball from moving. We shoot it, drive it, or move it until we get a 9 or a 7. When we're in a split, we're just trying to get there. We're trying to get that first domino to fall so we can expand our advantage by playing 0.5. So if you're frustrated with the ball sticking, the only thing I could think of, as without seeing any film, again, I usually have more questions the first time I read a question, would be maybe your players aren't getting in and out of the split fast enough. The pace in which you run the action is really important. So if I have two players going really slowly into a split, then yes, it's going to feel like the ball is sticking longer than it should. If players are moving quickly with really good pace in and out of that split, I don't think it would feel as much like a ball stick.
Two additional thoughts. I love the pace one. I don't like split action when the ball goes into the post. And by post, I mean deep post, like on the block. The reason why, my goal in split action is 9's first, 7's second, meaning we want to put pressure on the rim. It's really hard to put pressure on the rim with a cut when the ball is already by the rim. It's just bad spacing. So I would not trigger my split action by a post entry. I know that's kind of like a classic, you know, up screen, you know, dive scenario. I just don't think that creates the space that we want. I might go with like a porch entry, often maybe like a mid post entry, high post entry, but I wouldn't go deep post entry. I don't know how deep you're doing it, but that's just one thought. The second question would be like, who? Another opportunity for a trigger would be the who. I wouldn't want split action to be run when the ball is in the hands of one of my less dangerous, weaker passers. You're not going to get as much benefit from split action, which again, when you say post, you know, I'm assuming that maybe this is like a less dangerous, weaker passer. It requires like a really clever passer. And one of the other benefits of split action is it occupies help. And so it actually can create a double gap or triple gap for the ball handler to then attack and create dominoes as well. And so if we're running split action with the ball in the hands of, you know, not one of our better decision makers and more threatening players, then I think we're limiting the benefit as well. So two additional ways just to consider how you're triggering your split action.
That's good. You want to ask the next one, or you want me to keep going?
Keep going. I really like when you drive. I hate driving. Like, that's, you know, full self-driving is for me.
Okay. I know Elon's been driving you.
Elon's been driving me. He scared me the other day, but.
All right, let's go a lock left question. When initially teaching lock left positioning, do you teach players to run to spots on the defensive end and match up according to where they go? Or how do you teach them the five working together within the transition and getting to your job? I don't know if you followed that.
I did follow that. Okay. As with most questions, the answer is yes. So, however, whatever guidelines or principles you establish for your transition defense, the more they operate under that principle, they will learn to work together, and you'll have a different set of problems to solve. So if you have them run to spots and match up, there's going to be some problems that you identify. But if you stick to that being your principle, they're going to solve that problem. They'll create similar patterns over and over again and then create solutions to that pattern. If you have them match up with individuals, that's going to be a different set of problems to solve, but it'll be similar patterns and they'll get better at solving that problem. What I would not do is have no principle. And what I would not do is change your principles often, because then you don't get to solve the problems. Now, what I have found, because I have spent most of my time installing this defense in a very short period of time for a team and then leaving within 2 days, or working with a more club program where we practice once a week, are putting new players into the system very quickly, I have found more traction with spots and matching, because it's very clear to say, one job, zero excuses. Did you go to your spot and did you get matched up? And not allowing like, okay, we're going to match this player with this player and then solve that problem, because it solves the problems that we have. If I had a team 5 days a week for multiple hours a day, would I do it differently? Maybe, but I probably wouldn't start there because I want to be able to go play a game tomorrow really, really effectively.
That's good. Yeah, I think that's a common question that we get on lock left is the transition defensive element. So,
yeah, and I'll clarify as well. How I teach defensive transition roles is not spots and match. It's ball and match. So we have three players that are moving towards the ball. Three players on the ball. One who's guarding the ball, one that moves to one side of the ball, one moves to the other side of the ball, and you match relative to the ball, not spots on the floor. We have two players that go to a spot on the floor. And this is more, you know, this is more traditional as in like get back. We have someone that's getting the rack or getting the rim, right? And we got someone that's getting the nail. We want three near the ball and two in the middle of the floor. And that's how we match. So again, it's not all spots on the floor. I just couldn't let that one go.
Yeah. We always good transition defense. You get the basket, you get the ball, and then you match to the most dangerous. Right.
Yeah. And the most dangerous is going to be the nearest to the ball. And so that's why we put those there. So you're exactly right.
Yep. All right. Tyler, how would you attack a traditional, by traditional, we mean non-trapping 1-3-1 defense?
Race faster would be number one. Number two is I would play through porches more often. It's usually a pass, especially if it's non-trapping. I'm not too scared about playing through the short corner or the porch. And I would actually try to attack it from an inverted way, baseline up, as opposed to top of the key down. I would invert it. And we wouldn't be attacking the 1-3-1 for nines. We'd just more highly prioritize sevens. But we'd crack the shell through the porch. That's going to flatten that 1-3-1 and leave wide open sevens on inside out threes. Get to the porch, and then they become a passer for sevens. And then lastly, really prioritize offensive rebounding. It's really hard to rebound out of a 1-3-1, so I'd be sending five to the glass. Sevens and no rebound.
Yeah. I would attack it the same way I would attack any zone, right? Through our same principles is we're going to first start with our alignment. If they have one up top, we're going to have two up top, and that's going to determine our shape and our alignment, usually a four out, one in. Kind of a 2-1-2 alignment. But I've also done exactly what you're talking about. Have your traditional race in space or drive in space alignment with four out. You have two guards, two wings, and a porch player. We would prioritize spacing, which we just talked about through alignment. We'd prioritize ball movement. One thing I'll tell you, a tip I will give you on ball movement might be to look for diagonal passes, right? So if we get it down to the porch, or like you said, we're attacking for sevens, A lot of times those inside outs will be diagonal passes, but we're going to prioritize spacing, ball movement. And then at some point we're going to have to crack the shell with a dribble where if our seven isn't there, we drive, we get a paint touch. And now all of our concepts are there. We're going to go two out, click the ball. We're going to burn cut on dribble penetration. And then, like you said, we're going to crash the glass, but I'll also reiterate, let's shoot transition threes, baby. Let's get out there, run and put them up. That give them what they ask for. So something that's come up a lot, we can spend all of our time trying to figure out how to beat the one thing that the zone is designed to take away, right? I was talking with a coach the other day about a sagging or a packed in 2-3. And initially our conversation was geared around just like, how are we going to get in the paint? How are we going to get in the paint? It's like, well, man, like we can't go to the other bench and say, coach, can you please get your guys out of the paint? So if they're going to take away the paint, give them exactly what they're asking for and put sevens up and make them come out of the paint that way. But take what the defense gives you. Every defense gives something up and takes something away. Whatever they're taking away or whatever they're giving up, probably giving up corner threes, give it to them and make them adjust.
Do your JV and freshman teams run the same stuff as varsity? And if so, do you give the sub-varsity coaches freedom to do different things?
I love the way you asked that. Very good tone and tenor. They better be running the same thing that we are running.
This blows my mind. This is so common. Like what? It's so hard to get coaches. You know, they don't have a lot of time. They're not being paid. So you want to throw them a bone. Okay. I get the heart of it. But this is something that I would never compromise on. If you're actually trying to build a program.
Yeah, difference between coaching a team and running a program. The freshman coach's job is to prepare those players to play JV basketball. The JV coach's job is to prepare those players to play varsity basketball. The best way to do that is that we have program alignment, where we are all doing the same thing. It may look a little different, right? The end result may be different, but to me, we're all starting at the same point. We're all teaching the same things. We're aligning on our terminology. We're aligning on our first principles. And that's what running or leading a program is, right? And I also believe that what we do is the absolute best for our program and our players. So why would we do anything different? Now, I think the follow-up to that was, do we allow for creativity or something in there? I don't know, maybe, you know, what does that look like? What does creativity look like? If they wanted to create their own drills or games to teach the same thing, by all means, I think the best drills that you can do are the ones that come up, that you come up with, that solve your problems that you're seeing. So something that is happening in a JV practice, like you said, put them in that situation, recreate that situation. And that would be pretty creative for me. If my JV coach could do that, I think I had a heck of a JV coach.
Yeah. And all these conversations are easier in advance, you know, so when you're hiring, we all run the same stuff. This is the expectation. All the issues that I've had with this in our club program is when I wasn't really clear about that off the jump. And they're like, man, I feel like, you know, I don't feel really comfortable with the system. Can I just do this stuff? And then we had to have a hard conversation. But now the last three coach hires I've had is like, we all run the same stuff top to bottom. I will step into any game or any practice that you're running and take the lead for your training. That's what you're signing up for. Are you willing to do that? And we've had no issues since I've started just say that up front. How do you incorporate a young big man with potential who's not as skilled and possibly slower into your systems?
Oh, man. it doesn't sound like this player is going to play very much, I guess.
But he has potential, Mark. He has potential. He has
potential. Okay. So here's what I would say. Maybe this doesn't answer the question. You might have a better answer, but can we wait as long as possible to assign positions to players? So at the lowest levels, you know, if you're coaching third, fourth, fifth, sixth grade basketball, I think you should be developing basketball players, even if they come in and they're tall, right? That's the tallest player. He'll play the post. I think that's a huge injustice to that player. Maybe one day he is better suited to play the post, but I think we've all seen the player that is, I coached one that comes to mind right now. He's pitching for the Yankees, but he was a taller guard, but he ended up growing to be 6'7", and he played guard for us because we treated him like a guard when he was kind of a taller guard, right? So, yeah, I would say wait as long as you can to assign positions. I think all of your players have potential. Just we have to meet players where they're at. So some players need more work, more instruction, more time. So, yeah, I would treat every player the exact same as far as how would I incorporate them into the system, wherever their skill set fit the best. You know, we're going to teach every player every skill. And then when it's time to play in the game, hey, this is where you're best suited. I guess that sounds like that's the post. So we would be 4 out, 1 in, I guess.
Last question that I will answer. How do you teach high post defense in the lock left? I had a lot of success with lock left this summer, but we got hurt in the high post. We love the defense. I'm excited to dig into the fundamentals. All right. If we're doing our job early, you will be fully denying sniping the high post. What I mean by if you're doing the job early, if we're getting the ball to cross half court on the left-hand side and the ball's initially on the left-hand side of the court, left wing or jail, then we would be in a snipe position on the high post and the ball should never get there. If we don't do our job early or the ball gets skipped or reversed out of jail side to the free side of the floor, it's going to be easier for it to get there because we're actually going to be guarding more in the gap from the high post, but we're still trying to snipe. We're still going to try to steal the pass from the gap, but the ball is more likely to get there. Now, when the ball gets there, we want to make every catch a dribble, or we want to make the ball go. And that includes from the high post. We most often get hurt from the high post with them being passers. It's a very dangerous place to pass from. So if they do get the ball to the high post, then we got to make it go left from the high post. Now all of a sudden they're not a passer and they have to become a decision maker. And those players that tend to catch the ball in the high post tend to not be as good of decision makers off the dribble. They don't have as much experience dribbling and passing. So then you make it go. And if you can embrace those three steps, I think you'll be more successful in guarding the high post. All right, Mark, I got a proposal. I propose that we do not offer up a game of the week or a teach better segment this week because we went really, really deep into so many other things that I think include teaching better and how to gamify the principles that we were talking about. And we've gone way over time this week.
I was actually going to suggest combining those because we went way over time, but I think we basically, the whole podcast was about how to teach better. And then I would challenge coaches, come up with your own game and send it to us. And then we'll give you some feedback on it.
All right, beautiful. Let's get out of here on this. Mark, what is one thing or area that you're focused on for yourself this week? An identity piece, a growth piece, a mindset piece as a leader, teacher, coach, businessman, father. What's, we call it savvy grow for a reason. We're growth oriented. And without a vision for your growth, we probably won't grow. We'll just operate another week as we did last week. Let's each answer that one. What's your growth area this week, or what are you trying to lean into this week?
Yeah. A new form of journaling for me this week. So, reading a book called Storyworthy, which highly recommend, and I'm trying to take an activity from the book where every single day you write down the most storyworthy moment of your day. So if you had to tell a story from every single day, what would that be? You're limited to writing just one line. And what it's supposed to do is obviously allow you to reflect on the day, right? And not take things for granted. And as you do this more and more, when you're doing something that may seem mundane, you start to appreciate it a lot more. And you see the quote unquote stories and more things. So kind of a gratitude piece as well as an awareness piece.
That's awesome. I'm going to go small and practical. I'm committed to having a green drink, which is just your daily greens powder in water every single morning, just from a personal health standpoint. So even just saying that reminded me to get it done.
I've tried that. I got to find one that tastes a little bit better. I hate to be a sissy, but how does that one taste? It's okay?
This one actually has a little bit of sweetness. I think it's some apple. I'll send you the label of this one. It's off of Amazon, but yeah, I'll send you the label of this one.
Well, thanks for listening, everybody. Go get your green drink and stay savvy.
Stay savvy.